Hello, I'm Mari Kirk, Director of Engagement and Impact at the USSC. Thank you for joining us on the USSC Briefing Room. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we're recording on today. The University of Sydney is located on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and future. This is our final episode in the three-part series recorded following our Indo-Pacific Strategy Simulation in November 2023. This episode features Professor Peter Dean, Director of Foreign Policy and Defense here at the United States Study Center, in conversation with Jacqueline Borsboom, Managing Director for Australia at the Asia Group. Okay, I'll hand over to Peter now.
Jacqueline, thank you very much for joining us today on the USSC podcast. For our listeners, could you give us a quick rundown on your background, where you've come from, what you're doing now, what's your sort of experience that brings you into our orbit for studying the United States, Australia, and strategy in Asia?
Thank you, and thanks for having me. I've got a 20-year background in government, in the Australian government, and before that I was in the private sector. Many people don't know that because it's often not asked, but I was in the private sector in working for small and medium enterprises, so I have a background in that. And so after my posting as a Minister Counselor for Defence Policy in Washington, D.C., that was the last one I did. I moved on to work at the Asia Group, which is a for-profit organisation that advises, provides strategic advice to businesses big and small. During my time in government, I worked a lot in the international relations space of departments of defense, home affairs, and also prime minister and cabinet. I started my career actually working at the embassy in The Hague, where I did a lot of trade and tourism and kind of a lot of fun things, frankly.
Well, tough gig in The Hague.
Yeah, it's a tough gig in The Hague. I was local engaged staff there, and that's sort of what got me enthused about working for the Australian government. So I joined was a bit of a late-aged graduate when I joined defense. And so defense has probably been the longest stint for me. And in that, I've worked on all sorts of issues and challenges with a lot of fun, actually. Had a good time there.
So what we've been doing for the last sort of day and a half is looking at some of the region's flashpoints, and particularly looking at both US and Australian strategic policy and what the sort of discussion and key points are in those strategic policy circles at this particular point in time. So from your point of view, what do you really see is the at this moment in time of our strategic sort of history, what are the real strategic policy discussions that are happening from your time, you know, in the US? What are they really focused on? And where do you think that relates to the way Australia views the region?
Interestingly, during my time at the embassy in Washington, you would think that we were constantly talking about big global flashpoints and things like that. And we certainly did. I mean, and we had to respond to those things on the fly. But that was almost like could be quite a short job for the day. So the Chinese balloon issue, for example, was one of the last things I dealt with. And it ruined a few of our weekends. But it wasn't really, that's not where the bulk of the work was. The bulk of the work for me in the beginning was to kind of get within the defense bilateral relationship, the industrial work more as a serious pillar. So we were very focused on ops and very focused on intelligence and sort of shared geopolitical interests, but we did not really spend a lot of time on industrial base integration. And so that's the work I started doing when I first arrived, because I had experience in shipbuilding and I really wanted to move that forward. And then already came across early on with all of the disastrous legislation in place that you know, ITAR legislation and information sharing hurdles, et cetera, et cetera. So I got quite frustrated about that. Tried to and started a bit of a campaign on that, really saw that as a challenge. this was all during COVID, of course, so it wasn't an easy time to get your feet on the ground. But we got there nonetheless. But of course, what happened then was the AUKUS piece started to gain real traction. And that was a real privilege to be part of that. But that also opened up the whole the work that has since then been done on opening up the legislative piece for the US. So at the moment, the Prime Minister's visit sort of is testament to that. Other than the non-defense parts that are very important, including on critical minerals and climate change. But what's going on in defense, in my view right now, is a debate on, first of all, is the US still able to focus its attention on the Indo-Pacific while there's now two other conflicts that it's involved in? So that would be front of mind, I would imagine, for Deputy Prime Minister Miles and his team. And secondly, I also think that the mundane stuff is still very front of mind. And that's why Ambassador Rudd and his predecessor, Ambassador Zinedinas, are spending a lot of time talking to people on the Hill to make sure this really quite mundane legislation, which has become now kind of a central focal point in the relationship, to really push that through and make sure we get that in the defense legislation by the end of the year. It's, in my view, a bit of a make or break moment, but it's not as sexy and as great as a lot of people tend to think when you write academically on these type of flashpoints. It really becomes pretty boring very quickly in a way. But those things really matter because those are the instruments that are going to push forward Australia's ambitious agenda in the defence space and beyond that as well. So, yeah.
They are fantastically mundane on one level and fantastically important on another.
Yeah.
So here at USSC, we've done a lot of work on ITAR.
Yes,
That is one of the great acronyms that floats around the office here all the time and appears in much of our writing. So the International Traffic Arms Regulation in the United States. And the provisions around that. But as you said, they are critical to ensuring that the shared strategic agenda the United States and Australia has around AUKUS, but I think also more broadly, as you said, that defence industrial base work that you were talking about, and I would sort of probably highlight here to the importance of ITAR provision reforms to the Guided Weapons and Explosive Ordnance Enterprise that the Australian government has. So that's the manufacturing and building of missiles here in Australia, the licensing that comes with that, the deals that need to be done between US manufacturers if we're going to do this in Australia, and all the detailed commercial arrangements, legal arrangements, contractual arrangements, intellectual property deals that all hinge off US policy about whether or not they're allowed to actually export these things and whether or not we will be allowed to build them here in Australia. So that's critically important element of what's part of a broader, I suppose, response to what's happening to our strategic environment.
And for me, to see how in the last 3 to 4 years, this part of the agenda has really come to the surface. And so I really have been incredibly grateful for the work done by the study centre, but also other academics throughout, across the US and in Australia to really get to do real deep dives on this and really start get ministers and other decision makers to really understand how vital this is. And and so fingers crossed it's going to pass. It's not going to be the end of it. This legislation is just a first step. We have had a treaty in place for many years, the Defence Trade Treaty, and that never was implemented. So there's a huge cultural mind shift required. And I notice this when I'm now talking to the primes in America, in particular, who also have a foothold here. They're still very skeptical about how this is going to pan out. But part of the cultural change needs to come from them as well. And to get their minds to shift beyond foreign military sales and to really start to partner up with Australian companies and the talent that we have and make sure that develops in the right direction so that we are prepared for these contingencies that we've just exercised over the last 2 days.
So just to extrapolate on this, in your experience in Washington working in those areas, do you think that the conflict in Ukraine, which from my perspective is kind of highlighted in some senses the parlous state, if you want to call it, or the underdeveloped state of the sort of Western defense industrial basis. So stories have abounded around the difficulties of supplying Ukraine with artillery ammunition, for instance, as one of these things. Are you seeing the kind of the things that are surfaced through the conflict in Ukraine starting to affect the sort of cultural change or the ways of thinking about this, both in your work with the primes and in with private enterprise and through the Asia Group, as well as in your time in government? Or is that still not as front of mind as it should be?
I would like to be more optimistic about this. Initially, it looked as if, you know, that I remember the US system being very proud of itself that it was approving ammunitions to be sent to Ukraine, including Australian products to be sent to Ukraine, within 24 hours of the request coming through. But that was just a brief surge that we saw, and then it sort of became business as usual, but it's still through the prism of the Ukraine conflict. There still seems to be a bit of an inability to kind of extrapolate. There's a nervousness in the US that once you say yes to one country, all the rest of the world is going to come knocking on your door. And that's not an unreasonable fear. I think it did show the ammunitions shortage and the fact that we do need to get cracking on weapons production. So I do think that in the back of everybody's mind, the US system, they know that they need to move forward on this, and AUKUS hopefully will be that door opener, at least, and it will benefit us. Selfishly, it's going to benefit Australia and hopefully beyond the AUKUS legislation and the ship transfer legislation. I really am hopeful, and hope is not a strategy, I know, but I'm getting more confident that it's going to be a countrywide exemption or something short of that. And that means that it's going to be applicable to other parts of our bilateral relationship with the US.
And I think we saw some positive steps forward with the Prime Minister's visit, the legislation going back onto the floor, the additional money from the Biden administration in the submarine industrial base. So we'll wait and see whether this can move the domestic politics of the US of House of Representatives and Senate.
Yeah, it's the marrying of the legislation coming out of the House and the Senate is going to be, they're working on that like as we speak. And I saw an update from one of my connections on the Hill, sort of just before I left for Australia on Friday. And even she's been working on this for a long time. She's also cautiously optimistic, but it's like we whiteboarded a lot of scenarios on this legislation, but the Speaker of the House not having one for 3 weeks was not one of
them.
It
does create a bit of a difficulty.
Yeah, so there's always something, and I think that's what makes everybody still a bit nervous, and that's probably why Deputy Prime Minister Miles is spending time on the Hill, and I'm sure Ambassador Rudd will continue his campaign as well until the deal is done.
Well, we know Kevin, when he gets his mind to something, he's pretty relentless when
it
comes
absolutely.
Tracking things down.
And it's exactly what we need right now.
It's exactly what we need.
And right I don't now. Mind if that ruffles a few feathers in the White House or in the Pentagon. I have little sympathy there as much as I love my colleagues over there.
So you talked about whiteboarding these things out, and that's a good turn of phrase to turn to a little bit more directly what we've been doing for the last day and a half, which is looking at sort of crisis simulations, strategic simulations and war games. So can you just tell us a little bit about your experience with these types of simulations inside and outside government? What do you think the kind of real value from them, from your perspective, are of being involved in a strategic simulation or crisis simulation?
We just don't do them enough on the civilian side, and we should do them at least once a year. And I really, because every time I did one, and in fact, I counted them in preparation for this interview, I've only done two in the Australian system, and this is 20 years of defence and government. I did one at NATO when I was there. It was a multilateral exercise. And then I have done one in the US, and now you are my fourth. So that's shockingly low. And I remember when Duncan Lewis left the public service after a distinguished career, one of the things that he said in his last speech, he said that he was also very underwhelmed how poorly trained the public service is. And he didn't mean that he wasn't offending the public service. He has a lot of time for the public service and appreciates the work that is being done. But we don't train the public service well enough. And I don't mean writing courses or how to better do punctuation. Those things are important too. But what we don't do enough of is exercising at least once a year in our respective areas or even combined areas, crisis management in all shapes and forms. And because what it does do, once you get together, and I think the more different subject matter experts you get in the exercise and the more realistic the simulation is, the better it becomes. Because I must admit that the ones I did do were very good. But we just don't do them enough. And the reason, the newer and younger generation of public servants who have not been as, I sort of grew up in the department during a lot of the CT crisis. So the Bali bombings, the Mumbai bombings, and obviously post September 11. So there was unfortunately, it was a time where we had more crises to manage. And so it became second nature when you were in international policy and working with your military colleagues to go to DFAT when there was a crisis and then partake in the interdepartmental committee structures that we had. And that almost became second nature. And it's a sad reflection of that era. But unfortunately, what has happened is that we don't train people well enough for these type of crises. I remember having a cheat sheet for sort of to leave as a bit of a legacy when I left that part of defense and go to Brussels as a sort of like, this is what you do when in your region there's an earthquake or whatever, or a terrorist attack or something like that. This is what you need to do to support your seniors. But I think that one is probably sitting in the archives gathering dust in hard copy somewhere. So this is how long ago it was. So no, I can't rate simulations or exercising like this enough.
So what's the thing that, you know, obviously you enjoy them, you think they're useful and purposeful. What's the thing that you sort of take away from them? Is it the different points of view and opinions that you highlighted? Is it the different perspectives? Or talking to one of our other participants, Zach Cooper, about this, he spoke about the importance of not necessarily answering questions but figuring out what questions there are to ask. What do you sort of take away as what's so important about doing this? If you were able to grab a bunch of public servants out of International Policy Division today in defense and say you're going to go and do this crisis simulation, it's going to be good because you're going to learn about, and what would be the blank that you would fill in?
Well, first of all, how to work with your military colleagues in the case of defense, but also to work with other parts of defense. People are very stovepiped, and it's not an accusation. We all have to deal with the issues of the day, and we would like to think more holistically and plan more forward, but we often don't because we just run out of time. We just never have enough time on our hands. So it's very easy to work in a bit of a bubble, and because we tend to then hire the same people. They're all coming from similar backgrounds and universities and things like that. So you become a bit of a self-licking ice cream, really.
And I love that expression.
And exercises like this are going to force you to think like not just put yourself in the shoes of military, but also I've done one that was whole of government, so it put myself in the shoes of how the police thinks and how the order of events are when, for example, the Lindt Cafe happened. We had exercised that not too long before, and I really understood what the order of events was going to be like. Who was going to be responding at what particular time? And it's just So the exercises help you look at things from different points of view. Yeah, anticipate complex questions and then also anticipate what the response is going to be. So that when you actually do get yourself in a situation like this, even though it's not literally the same situation, you are going to become a better policy officer or a better advisor because of exercises like this, because you kind of can think ahead and know when to call that particular expert that you're going to need. Because the other problem is that we often find is we think we're an expert in everything. And I have caught other colleagues from different disciplines do the same thing, but getting together and really sharing points of view, anticipating, knowing what response you're going to provide is key to this.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Jacqueline, and for your insights from both your time in Washington, D.C. in the embassy, your time now with the Asia Group, and also your broader reflections on your time with us for the last day and a half for the USSC strategic simulation in the Indo-Pacific.
It was good fun. Thank you.
As we wrap up, I'd like to point out a couple of other podcasts that may be of interest. Our CEO, Dr. Michael Green, is co-host of the Asia Chessboard podcast with Jude Blanchett, the Freeman Chair for China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'd also recommend checking out our USSC Live podcast series that runs recordings from our major live events, including the panel discussions from the inaugural Sydney International Strategy Forum. You can find these on our website, ussc.edu.au, or wherever you get your podcasts.